Brunel is where I feel like I found my people. I was so excited to go to uni. I was really excited. So my job kept me on part-time when I went to uni. When I eventually left my recruitment work, I managed to get a job for a year in my sandwich course for Warner Music Group. That's when I really realized how important cultural fit is. They were like, where do you celebrate Christmas? So I was like, oh, just at home. And they were like, what, in Streatham Fell? I was like, yeah. They were like, oh, they celebrate Christmas in the ghetto. This is what one of the interns said to me. I felt rejected by the music industry. I always wanted to go back. I could do sales for anything apart from my old peers. That's the one thing I couldn't do because there was too much rejection and shame attached to it. As soon as I got into TV, that's when I started picking up music contracts again. If you've got a team, you have to be paid last. So I was doing social for this tech marketplace. So I was doing social for them. And then the ad agency saw me on them. And then the ad agency put me on this other platform to get paid. So then I connected with ITV on this platform. Turned out the show was Love Island. Anywhere you go, you're going to be given editorial guidelines. You need to make sure that your tweets performed well. Otherwise, you're not doing your job or you're not good enough at what you do. You have to make sure you get the moments that the people are talking about. I've been saying no to a lot of full-time jobs coming my way. I think sometimes people just focus on the sexy things they do. But I think sometimes if you want that, you've got to do those other things.
How do you define leadership?
And welcome to Everyday Leadership, podcast where you get to listen and learn how to lead yourself personally and professionally through the lessons and life experiences my guests share in the hope that it challenges and inspires you to lead yourself from the inside out and not the outside in.
Welcome to another episode of Everyday Leadership, and today I have the pleasure to have a conversation with someone who spends a lot of her time, I'm going to say behind the scenes, you know, working with amazing brands like ITV, Universal Music, BBG, Uber, and so much. And, you know, when she decides to step out front and center, she killed it. She won some one awards, you know, BBC One Reality Tea podcast. She came through and scooped the award a couple of years ago, which is absolutely amazing. And now she has her own podcast as well as still doing her creative work. I'm talking about Pillar. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. What an intro. Thanks so much for that. Sometimes you like get caught up on the next thing, you forget, oh, you know what? I've done some stuff. I should be proud of myself.
Speaking of that, what is it that you are most proud of in when you look at your illustrious career, which you're going to delve into? What are you most proud of?
I think career-wise, what I'm most proud of is just following my curiosity, I would say, because I'm the kind of person, as my career shows, I'm interested in different things. So I think that fight in me to just still go and try something new, even if it's outside my comfort zone, like podcasts is not something I did before. And when the opportunity presented itself, it was so much easier to stick to what I was doing because we were killing it, if that makes sense. But no, I went for the unknown, and yeah, I'm just proud that I've still got that in me, because the older you get, the harder it is to try new things, in my opinion, for me anyway.
So if we were to then wheel it back to a younger you then, 6-7 Pillar, what were you like then?
Oh, I was the same. Like, my mum used to call me inquisitive, so I was just asking all the questions. I wouldn't shut up. She always tells a story that one time we were out somewhere and I was asking her questions and a woman told her off. She was like, don't ignore your child. Mom was like, you wouldn't shut up. You're just asking me a million questions. So I think I was just the same. I would just talk a lot and ask a million questions.
In those days, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do and become? Because obviously kids tend to have aspirations and obviously changes over time. But did you have something in mind when you were, think of those age?
Not really. I think when I was that age, like apart from school and stuff, we would, what was big? Maybe the Spice Girls. Maybe I thought I'd be a Spice Girl or singer. And the truth of the matter is I have not got one decent note in my body. So that was a myth.
Then you started to evolve. Teenagers, university. You went to the infamous Brunel.
Brunel. Honestly, wow. What a community we got from that place.
Yeah. Like there's so many. I never went to Brunel, but I spent, even though I wasn't actually there, I spent a lot of my time there because a lot of friends were there, ACS, all those different things. But for real, there's been a massive crop of amazing talent that's kind of come out of, I want to say that generation in particular, that period of like, there's like a 5-year period where the number of people my age and a couple of years younger than me who are doing amazing things right now, who all came from that Brunel kind of environment. I'm curious, so what was at university, what was it about that environment that birthed or nurtured, should I say, that curiosity that you had?
Oh my gosh, Brunel is where I feel like I found my people, if that makes sense. You go there, and especially I have to give so much credit to the ACS. The president at the time was Sam, and all the people he had around him, all the people in within that ACS, they had such a spirit of entrepreneurship. And as soon as I got there, I was just like, I need to be part of this ACS. Like, it's amazing. So when it came to my year, I made sure I was part of it. I was head of arts. And I just think that being around a community of like-minded people, it really made us think bigger than the campus that we were on. Everyone was already trying to do big things. Everyone was reading these like Rich Dad, Poor Dad books. I don't think I ever read that actually, but everyone was thinking big. A lot of people had businesses. Someone was selling, I can't remember who it was, someone sold black hair care products on campus. So there was really a spirit of entrepreneurship, even down to the people that were just like holding events, holding comedy shows, cooking food, selling it. It was just a spirit of entrepreneurship, and we're not going to stop. We're going to be whoever we think we are. That was the community that I was around. And I'm so grateful for that community because it's birthed so many friendships that I have today. So many, I would say as well, just connections that I have even in my career today. I don't go anywhere without seeing somebody from Brunel. They just pop up everywhere, and everyone is just doing so well in their individual pursuits as well. It was just like, it's just like having inspiration on your doorstep. Sometimes you don't need to read those books. You just need to look around at the community around you.
You said that's where entrepreneurship came a thing for you. So prior to going to Brunel, did you go in there with a particular mindset of, I'm going to go in, I'm going to study, I'm going to leave, go and do my business management that you went in for? Or was it just, I'm just going to go in and see what happens?
So I did a business course. Like, I'm not necessarily new to the business environment, if that makes sense, like family-wise. So I wasn't new to it, but it's not something that I really, it didn't steep into me, if that makes sense. It's like they were doing their thing. I took a gap year before I went to uni, and I did something very different from what I do now. I did recruitment for a year. So when people would meet me, So when people would meet me, they would say like, oh, what do you want to do? And I'd be like, I'm going to do one of two things. I'm either going to go into entertainment. At the time, I thought I wanted to do public relations. I'll say, I'm going to do PR. I want to be big in media. I want to be like a female Diddy. Or the other thing I said I'll do is I'm going to run my own recruitment agency because it's what I knew. So I already had those kind of, I was used to a business environment anyway, but I never, when I went there, I just went there for, oh, let me go for the uni experience. Let me go and have fun. I didn't realize I would meet people that would be instrumental in what I did next.
When you took that gap year and you're seeing a year out, you're working, you're learning, you're earning, and then you go into a uni environment. I always ask this question to people who do that. What was that shift like for you? Because you're not earning money. And then you now go to not really earning much at university in that complete environment. Was it hard to make that transition? And did that stick in your mind that, you know what, I'm going to be in a position where I'm actually earning and looking after myself?
No, I was so excited to go to uni. I was really excited because I feel like the environment I was in at work, I missed that social element. And I could see a lot of my friends went before me. I would see what they were doing or hear all the exciting stories. Sometimes I would go to their unis, and I felt that I was just missing out on that. So I was really excited to go. I didn't leave my job, so my job kept me on part-time when I went to uni. So I was still doing recruitment part-time, and it wasn't too far from Brunel. I used to travel very far for that job that I had. It was in Finchley Road, which wasn't too far from Brunel. So they just kept me on. I would go there twice a week. And then during the summer holidays, I would work full time.
So you actually kept, that's a lot then, because you're holding down the job, obviously studying at university, involved in the ACS, which was, like you said, super busy. So that in itself was like a full-time role. So you were juggling a lot of things from a very young age, it sounds like. And you knew how to hold multiple roles and multiple responsibilities, but do them well.
Yeah, that never changed for me, if I'm being honest. Like, I've always been a busybody. That hasn't changed.
So when you were at uni, you started business management, and then you moved and you changed your, let's call it your major, you changed your degree to start doing finance as well. Why did you make that transition?
Because I felt like the general one was too easy, if I'm being honest. I felt general was too easy. I thought marketing was also too easy. So I decided to pick up accounting. My dad was an accountant as well. So that's probably helped my choice. I'd always heard, growing up, I'd always heard ACCA. So I knew if I did that, I had points off to go and do an ACCA if I chose to do that. I didn't have any intention. So I just thought, okay, let me choose this challenging thing. And it really worked out, because what happened is I took another gap year. You know when you take a gap year in a sandwich course? And I managed to get a job in... So this is when I eventually left my recruitment work. I managed to get a job for a year in my sandwich course for Warner Music Group. And I worked within their artist relations for a year unpaid. And what happened after that is I thought, I'm not going to go back to uni. This is the, like, you know, I witnessed life.
You made it.
I was like, this, I'm here. This is it. I ain't going back. And obviously an African mom, she was like, you're going back. You are going back. But I managed to find another part-time role for Universal Music Group. It was 2 days a week. So it worked perfectly with me going back to uni, because I was looking for full-time music roles and I wasn't getting anything. It's not that I wasn't good enough. Sometimes that's when I really realized how important cultural fit is, because I would go into these meetings, management meetings, marketing meetings, and I wasn't looking like the people around me. So I wasn't getting any full-time work. And the only thing I got was this part-time role, 2 days a week doing, like, as a digital assistant. And it worked perfectly with going back to uni and doing the accounting, business management of accounting course, because we had more time off than the other kind of, what would I call it? The other options within business and management. So that was the only one that gave me that time off. So it worked perfectly.
Would you recommend to someone listening to take on non-paid intern position like you did, or would you say from now on, based on hindsight, being a lot older, find something that is a paid internship instead?
I mean, it worked for me, but we've got to understand that 2024 is a different market. 2024 is a different market. Actually, that was in 2008, so the recession was there, but It was there then, but it wasn't affecting us personally. Do you know what I mean? It was affecting our parents. Now we are, that's who we are now. So it's a different market. What I would say is, people talk about privilege, right? And maybe what I didn't realize at the time is that having family that lived in London was the privilege for me. So many people that I met during the internship, they never stuck around doing the intern, and they never stuck around in the industry because their families didn't live in London. So it's like, how could they pay their rent? You know, they were getting burnt out trying to do the internship, go to all of the events that it demands, and trying to do part-time work to pay their bills. It was unsustainable for a lot of people. And realistically, when I look back, I was only able to do that because I had the support of my mum. I stayed at home. I tried to work part-time where she was working. I tried to work part-time there. She got me a weekend job. I couldn't hack it because I was just so tired from the internship. So I would say honestly, you've got to look at your environment and see if it's conducive for you to do. If you have the support system around you, if you don't have to pay rent, you don't have to pay mortgage, you don't have to pay for the kids to go to nursery, and you've got this dream, go for it. But if you don't have those things, I would say, like, don't put yourself out of pocket trying to follow something that's not for you. I wouldn't do that in this current climate. No, I wouldn't. And also, I think now legislation is in place to avoid people working for a year. But for me, it worked a dream.
What are some of the highlights of that year for you?
Honestly, I could sit here and name drop for the next 10 minutes because I was meeting people that I only saw on TV. I thought, wow, this is insane. I was really gassed. But I would say as well is that I learned how other people lived. So it was that, for me, it was learning how to adapt to other environments. I would go to dinners and I wouldn't know which like knives and forks to use. And my boss was so accommodating. He would be like, use this one, use that one. So I wouldn't feel so left out. So I would say it was actually less the skill set, but more the learning to adapt to other environments, other classes, so to speak. Because once you learn how to communicate with a different range of people, I think that's what actually carries you in different environments, different workplaces. You learn to adapt, even if you're so different from them. So I think that was the key skill that I actually learned.
And that's a very, when I think about navigating, especially the world of work, adaptability is important, it's so imperative. I think a lot of times people lean in with the whole, I need to be myself. I'm like, yeah, you can be yourself and be authentic, but you also need to know your environment so that you know how to be able to actually bring yourself into that environment in a way that feels authentic to you, but doesn't alienate other people as well. And there's an ebb and flow of learning and understanding that which people don't always take on board, to be honest. And that's why it can sometimes be really, really bad. There's some environments that are toxic, don't get me wrong. But there's a way of also being able to handle those conversations and maneuver in those spaces. It sounded like you had a very good boss who just leaned in and just saw you and helped you out.
My whole team, that whole team leaned in. Because you've got to imagine, like, what I've just said is I was lucky that I had a family home in London. A lot of other people there was a few people like me, but a lot of the other people on internships, they've got their own flats. Their parents live in the Buckinghamshires and the Shires. Do you understand? Like, they're a whole different class. It's a big class system that you're learning to adapt with. And I remember one time it was Christmas. So everyone was like, oh, so what are you doing for Christmas? At the time I lived in Streatham, they were like, oh, what are you doing for Christmas? Like, where do you celebrate Christmas? So I was like, oh, just at home. And they were like, what, in Streatham Fell? I was like, yeah. They were like, oh, they celebrate Christmas in the ghetto. And so I realized, yeah, this is what one of the interns said to me. So you understand, like, whereas for them, they would have chefs, they would have all this other stuff. Do you know what I mean? And my boss was, he would always, and I would just be stunned, but my boss was always the one that would like stand up for me, if that makes sense. Like, it's like he or the team that I was with had that voice, and they probably would never remember these things, but I remember them because it was so nice for me to have someone else advocate for me. Or even like, we would get so busy that I wouldn't have time to look after myself. And they'll be like, and you know, you go to the hairdresser on a Saturday, and before that was the times they had no like booking systems or anything. You go there, they're like, what did you do on your Saturday? I said, I stayed in the hairdresser the whole Saturday waiting to get a weave done. And then what they'll do is when it was quiet, they would let me go during the week to go and get my hair done so that I can actually have a Saturday to like rest and do other stuff. It's all those little things that I realized that, wow, I had a great group of people to introduce me to the world of work.
That is really good.
Yeah,
it was very, very considerate. So you go from there to a different environment where you're working 2 days a week, still in the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing at this point you're thinking, right, I'm in the music game. This is going to be me. You know, your dissertation was around music and or how the internet's kind of changing. So it sounds like you were very much like, music is my focus, 100% locked in.
Yeah, yeah.
When did that change?
It changed when I got made redundant. But even before that, even before I got made redundant, they had approached me. So I was there till I graduated. So after I graduated, I was still doing 2 days a week. I thought I would get a full-time role. That didn't happen. They kept me 2 days a week. So they started speaking to me like, listen, this full-time role thing's not going to happen here. We would recommend and suggest to you that you start freelancing, like start taking other roles. Even when I was with them, I was going through like an agency. So it wasn't a permanent job. It was an agency role, which was very common at the time. Still is quite common, keeping the headcount down, but still getting extra resources. So they started speaking to me about freelancing. And I was just like, I was so disgusted at the idea. I was like, no, I want to be part of a team. I want to be like in the office. I want to do this. I want to do that. And they were like, it's not going to happen. And eventually I started picking up. The more I went out, the more I made more contacts. I made a contact with this girl that worked for a PR company. They were bringing out a coffee table book around hip hop. So I got that contract to do social media for that. So then now I started building a client base. And then when I got made redundant, you know what that's like. So the shame of that was so deep, and I was so upset, I was so hurt. I was like, oh my gosh, my career, my life is over. And I was like, I'm never going back to work for anybody again. So then what had to happen is I had to start finding ways to get clients. So I realized that, okay, so the music industry is one of the first industries that was affected by digital marketing, the internet, social media. They embraced it quite early. I was like, who else would need my skills? So I started doing work for restaurants. I started doing work for what now would be a tech platform. I started doing work for different types of people. So because I thought it was really easy to pick up those clients, if I'm being honest, because I said to them, hey, I work in the music industry. I've done this and that for this person and that person and this person. I could do that for your restaurant. And they would just be like, yeah, okay. Wow. So that's how I started kind of expanding outside of music. But I was just doing it for, it was more like consumer brands were easier to do it for. Consumer brands, anything kind of linked to media, but big businesses weren't really for the social media thing. So I was just picking up little clients, and that sustained me for quite a while until an advertising agency said, hey, come in and do this for us in-house as a freelancer.
You say, but even having the boldness, the courage, the audacity just to lean in and be like, this is new, you haven't done it, let me ask a question. That's still a skill set and a mindset to be able to have that approach, because the other people be like, oh, you know what, this music thing hasn't worked, I'm going to go down a particular road, a particular lane. You leaned into something that was brand new right at the start of it. So I'm sure there was a bit of a, this is not the most secure path to go down on, but you were willing to feed that curiosity and step into it. And by doing those small little things, what led to other people recognizing the skill set that you have to working with a big agency as Bartle Bogle.
But you got to remember, I come from a recruitment background. I was doing sales. Sales came second nature, you know? So that was like, okay, I could do this. And then, but obviously as well, it came from the fact that I felt rejected by the music industry. I felt rejected by them, so I leaned away. But I'm going to be honest with you, I was doing these little clients and I was like, I miss the lifestyle. I was missing it, honestly. I'd be there doing my little clients. My friends would be at shows, gigs, live performances. I was like, wow, my old life looks real good right now. I miss it. I missed it. I had this business, but I missed the excitement. I can't lie to you.
So I can't even imagine that. Because even though you're doing your own thing, and people are like, oh, you can't compare the life. I'm like, no, reality is, if you're seeing someone living that lifestyle that you had previously and you want to be out there doing that, that's always going to be hard. That's always going to be tough. But did you ever think, even though you felt rejected and you're seeing your friends still doing that, was there a part of you that still wanted to go back there and just prove them wrong?
Yeah, no, I always wanted to go back. It's just that I could do sales for anybody, for anything apart from my old peers. That's the one thing I couldn't do because there was too much rejection and shame attached to it. So I could pitch to anyone apart from them. So I waited until it came back to me.
So you had to, they had to, like, you know what? Rather than you going to them and facing any rejection whatsoever ever again, is like, no, you're going to come to me. I'm going to just do me and focus on me, and they're going to come to me, and that'll be the change that needs to happen for you.
Yeah, but it took years. There's too much pride. I had too much pride, too much shame. It took years. I got the gig in the advertising agency, and I was like, okay, this is a step closer to what I was doing, but it still wasn't that, you know? It was a step closer, but it still didn't give me that excitement that my old life had. And then I transitioned into TV, and I finally thought, you know what? Okay, I'm back now. Like, I'm back here, I'm happy. And as soon as I hit TV, that's when, because I was still in touch with all my old colleagues and everything like that. As soon as I got into TV, that's when I started picking up music contracts again. Because it's like, now they thought, oh, okay, she's back. She's doing something worth, you know, giving her some work or something. You know, those places, so fickle.
Would you go back and change anything about the way you approach that? I.e., would you get over your anger, your pride, your rejection, and go back in and see if there was any way route forward? Or do you think things had to play out the way they did just to help you grow and develop as a person?
No, I think I would change that. I think pride isn't a good thing. So I would go back and change that. But obviously I had to learn a hard lesson. So it went that way. But I do think the trajectory of what I'm doing would be different if I wasn't so prideful.
In what way?
I probably would have done... I don't know. I probably would have stayed in music. I don't know if I would say I would be further along, but I probably would have ended up doing more permanent-based work rather than freelance work. I think that's the difference. If I had been given maybe like a digital marketing role in music for an agency, I think I would have gone down that route. Where it would have taken me, I don't know, but that's what I reckon I would have done.
Have most of your roles, or all your roles, always been like freelance all the way throughout your career?
Yeah.
You've never had a 9-to-5 standard in-house, in-office kind of role?
No.
Wow. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for you?
It's all I know. Well, you
never wanted to change it, though. That's what I'm trying to think. Like, have you ever actually thought to yourself, would it be different if I was in a 9-to-5 locked in an office like everyone else does? Or do you actually enjoy having the freedom to be able to just do you, pick up multiple projects and not be tied down to one client case? Things aren't going well, you can just bounce.
Yeah, I like the freedom.
That's good.
I do. I like it. I do. I like it. Not saying that I'm not anti, like, because I have, when I did the advertising agency work, because you know when you freelance, you can freelance in multiple different ways. So there are times I work as almost like a contractor where you do go into their office. So that's what I did with that advertising role. They had actually offered me a permanent role, but I was like, no, thanks. It wasn't for me at that time. So it's not that I don't go in. Even now, as a freelance producer, you do sometimes have to go to the studio. It's not that you completely work 100% remotely. So freelancing works in different ways. Some people freelance and work more as a business, some work as an individual. So it's not that I'm opposed to going in places. It's just that I think I don't like the feeling of being tied down to one thing, unless it's my own thing.
So how do you, we had your own thing, didn't you? You used to run your own social media agency even before you went into BBH, just doing your own thing, had a couple of people working for you. What was it like being the boss, having people working for you and being in that space? What learnings came out for that for you?
Honestly, I just wasn't very prepared. And when I say I wasn't prepared, is like what made me hate it was cash flow issues, to be quite transparent. Like, the cash flow thing was kicking my butt. It was kicking my behind, right? And I had people to pay. I had an office as well. I had office rent. I just hated the financial aspect of it, you know? I wasn't prepared. And I realized that was the kind of clients that I was working for. So when I stopped that, that's when I started contracting. I took the contracting role so that I could make sure I was hitting my payments on time. And it was so interesting because I was probably making the most amount of money. I was making so much money when I added the contracting onto the business, because the contracting, I would get paid weekly. So that would like sustain the cash flow. And then it's like the money from the business would come when it would come. So I was making so much money, but I was so like miserable. I was burnt out. I was miserable. And I decided to just let go of, I handed back a lot of my contracts, let go of the people, and just leaned in to contracting. And it felt so good to be like, wow, I have my life back. I actually have disposable income that I can spend on myself. Like, let me go take myself to a nice gym, have a spa day, have a massage, you know, go out with my friends on a Saturday and not think about like the fact that I have bills to pay. I wasn't ready for that. And then I think that's the difference as well between people. Not everyone who's a freelancer needs to be a boss, so to speak. You've got to understand your style of working, you know, and you've got to understand some people are made to have multiple staff, and some people are not made for that. I didn't like that. I'll be quite transparent. I didn't like that. And after that, and then when I went into contracting, I realized that, wow, I'm getting paid more and I'm doing less. So that's when I made a decision to, and this is not like a hard set rule for everybody, but I made a decision to stop working for small businesses and only work for recognized companies, because I knew that what would happen is that I would always get paid. And at least if they have a 90-day payment term, they would tell me up front so I could manage my cash flow. And then I learned that when you are freelancing, because I see a lot of people, especially on Twitter, complain about, you know, not getting paid. Oh, how am I going to pay my bills? This person is taking so long to pay. But you have to learn and adapt that this is how it's going to be. I don't care if the government do this new thing. I think they put a new thing in place last year that everyone has to get paid within 30 days. That's been the thing forever. It's never going to change. They will see that 30 days and not pay you. You've got to adapt so that you are not at the mercy of other people's payment terms. You've got to save. You've got to be good with your money so that those issues don't arise. So that was the lesson I had to learn then when having staff and having that agency, to make sure that now I can enjoy freelancing because I know how it goes. I know people take a long time to pay. You've just got to make sure that you're savvy with your money so it doesn't hit you like that. And when you get to that place, you enjoy work so much more. And it also gives you a bit of freedom in terms of the kind of work you want to take on or don't want to take on. So that's what I would say. Like it gave me a lot of lessons and a lot of learning in terms of the kind of freelancer I am. So now when I manage teams for like podcast productions, I'm not paying anyone myself. I make sure the companies that have got me on board are paying everybody. So that's how we work it. I'm not paying anybody. And if I am paying people and stuff, I'll make sure that I can fully take on the cost of the production before going into the production. So that kind of stuff comes with experience, you know. People see a huge budget and they will think, yeah, I'm rolling in the money. No, you've got to account for every single thing you've got to pay for, all the people you've got to pay for, all the equipment you've got to pay for, all the transport you've got to pay for. So those are the things that now when I see like a, you know, when I'm presented with a budget, I don't look at the budget and think, yeah, I'm in the money. I look at the budget and I say, okay, who is everybody I've got to pay? When do they need to get paid by? Can I take the cost up front if I take this contract, can I pay these people up front in case that payment comes in late? Because a lot of times the payments do come in late.
If you haven't already, can you please follow the podcast? It really helps us grow and it tells the apps that it's a podcast worth listening to, which the fact that you're listening to means that it is and other people need to know about it. In Apple Podcasts, if you click the three dots in the top right of your app, look for the follow button and click on it. And in Spotify, the follow button should be just below the show's artwork. Now let's get back into today's episode.
This for me is just a good example of why the experiences that we go through shape us to help us get better. Because actually there are a lot of people who never have had experience that you did, who will be looking after budgets, and they're not thinking that way. They're thinking money's big, and then they'll get to somewhere like, oh, money's run out. We still got people we need to pay. We have not got to the end of the shoot. Just like, there's so much stuff that still has to happen for the whole run. But you can take your experience and tailor like, nope, I know what it's like. And you can just map everything out up front. That's why organizations will obviously snap up people like you, because you know all of that. You have the business acumen, as well as the work and everything else that's involved that's needed and required. And it's that amalgamation of both those two elements, I think, really help to shape us. But so many times we don't pull on those threads of our experiences and we think, oh, that didn't work out, let me bury it. Like, no, you learned a lot from that. Use that as your fuel to kind of help you get better and to make a difference as you go forward.
Yeah, 100%. And also, it's just understanding that you'll be paid last. That's the biggest thing anyone has got to go into anything, understanding that if you've got a team, you have to be paid last. Everyone else, you need to look after your people.
It's not as glamorous as sexy as people think. I want to run my own thing. It's like, yeah, nah, you got people to look after, bills to pay, the tax man to pay, VAT to pay, and so much stuff needs to come out of your pocket. So when I then look at you having that organization, shutting that down, how did you then transition into TV that you mentioned earlier, like working with ITV and all those different other shows that you kind of worked on? How did that come about for you?
Funny enough, so what happened with the advertising agency? So I was doing social media for a platform. It's one of those platforms, I don't want to say the name of the platform, but you know, I had read this book called The 4-Hour Work Week. And The 4-Hour Work Week, yes, it was all about outsourcing. So I was like, oh my gosh, I've got this social media skill. Let me join these different platforms so that I can sell my skills on them. And then one of the platforms, I became a top seller and they got me on board to do their social. So I was doing social for this tech platform. I'll call it a tech marketplace. So I was doing social for them. And then the ad agency saw me on there and was like, hey, you come in there. So I went with the ad agency. And then the ad agency put me on this other platform to get paid. It's a great platform for people who freelance across creative roles and tech roles. So I was getting paid weekly on this platform, but they didn't hire me through it. They were friends with them. They're like, hey, we want to pay her. We don't want delays. You know how the delays goes. We don't want delays. We just want to pay her weekly. Put her on your platform. They put me on this platform. So then I connected with ITV on this platform. So then I made the move again. With them, it was just a 6-week contract. Go in, work on a show. They were like, come in, 6-week contract, work on a show. Turned out the show was Love Island. I was like, no way. Was meant to be 6 weeks. As these things go, you make relationships with the people. Again, one of the best teams I have ever worked with. Amazing team. I learned so much from them. Made relationships with the social lead and the senior producer there. And 6 weeks turned into a couple of years. And with those roles, you know, you get booked on shifts. So I would go in for 6 weeks and then it might be like a couple of days here, a couple of days there. And eventually it turned into me having like, I was always promised a certain amount of shifts a week because I became part of their core team. And that would range from some days you would be in the office, other days would be remote because it's TV. You can watch the TV from home. You can live tweet from home. And it was a great gig. I loved that gig so much.
You're just live tweeting, or what else were you doing for the show?
No. So when you worked remotely when you were live tweeting. So if you're working remotely, you're live tweeting. If you're working in the office, those are creative days. On your creative days, you're coming up with, so you're given a brief for a show and you get the brief, you have to come up with campaign ideas, you have to come back with strategies, you have to come up with, you have to do your content calendars, you work with an editor to create the different visuals and video assets, people see the memes, you know. So when you're in the office, that's your creative days. You go, you think, you present, you're presenting to your lead, you're presenting to the marketing team, you're presenting to account managers. That's what you do when you're in. And then when you're working from home, you're live tweeting in the evening as the shows are happening. So it's two different skill sets for the same role.
So I have a lot of trust to you, just give you free rein to actually live tweet, because there's no filter, there's no one checking that. That's just you on the organization's account, their live account, tweeting as them. Were there any guidelines of what you could say and couldn't say, and how did you ensure that you were staying true to the brand and not saying anything that was in your mind? You're like, yeah, people might say that, but they wouldn't necessarily say that. So let me ensure that it's all lined up.
Yeah, anywhere you go, you're going to be given editorial guidelines, and you know, the bigger the place, the stricter the guidelines are. There's guidelines, there's compliance, and then it's your role. My official role there was a social creative. It's your role as a creative to take those guidelines and create content that is still engaging, that does not get you in trouble with the guidelines. So anywhere you go, there's the bigger the company and the more stakeholders they have, the more guidelines they are. And even though someone might be trusting you, it's a lot of pressure as well, because you know, the stakeholders that you don't even know, the CEOs, that's what they see. They might not know your name, but they're going to check the social. If someone is a CEO of a company, or their friends, their children, their family, their colleagues, if they see something online for the company they represent, they send it to the CEO, or they send it to the, you know, somebody senior on the board or whatever. That's almost like, it's like a shop front for people, because people don't know the inner workings of a company. So you, live tweeting might sound like a minor job, you know what I mean? But it's a big deal, because everyone sees that. You have to ensure that no one you've never met who's really senior is getting a message saying, oh, there's a typo on this. Oh, this is a bit inappropriate, you know? You don't want to say anything that the press can pick up as well in a negative way. So you've really got to understand the guidelines. But then also, there's also pressure in terms of, you know, for TV, the shows that happen in the morning and in the night, especially in the evening, those are the big shows. And they compete against each other for ratings, overnight ratings. You all see what the overnight ratings are the next day. So you have a job to try and make moments as viral as possible. And every time you finish an evening shift, you have to send it to your team, your best performing tweets of the day, your best performing Instagrams of the day, of your shift. So it sounds like, oh yeah, it's just free rate. No, there's a lot of pressure, because there is a team that's waiting to see how did you perform, and how is this going to affect the overnights that come in the next day, the numbers. Like, if it was a big show and the overnights are good, you need to make sure that your tweets performed well. Otherwise, you're not doing your job, or you're not good enough at what you do. You have to make sure you get the moments that the people are talking about.
This is stuff that you never actually think about, but this is the operational side of things to ensure that shows actually do well. And shows like Love Island and just all the different shows you're involved in, were these shows that you watched previously and you had an interest in, or did you treat it as, okay, I need to get an interest in this to ensure that I tweet the viral moment or I capture the right moment so it does well on that night?
Yeah, I mean, I love reality TV. People don't know that about me. I love reality TV. Listen, give me a Real Housewives, give me a Love and Hip Hop. I love that stuff. It's my guilty pleasure, okay? So the reality stuff I watched anyway, but even though you work on shows like, you live tweet shows like Love Island, when Love Island's not on, you might be live tweeting a show like 100-Year-Old Drivers. That's not a show I would have necessarily watched, but you had to live tweet it. You learned about it, or Britain's most loved dogs, you know. You have to be able to adapt to different shows, different voices, different tones of your tone of voice has to adjust to the show, to the channel. And remember, when you're working for a broadcaster has more than one channel. They have like three or four channels. So each channel has a different tone. So you switch between, depending on what you have to gauge, what are the big shows this night on the different channels, and then you prioritize which ones you're going to work on. So like 6 to 7pm, you might be on this one, one channel, one show. Then 7 to 8pm, you switch the channel, you switch the show, and you have to switch your tone of voice as you switch between it. I would even be put on, if football was big and it happened to fall on my shift, they're not going to cancel me and put a man on the show. I have to live tweet the football. I have to live tweet the rugby. I'll have to live tweet, you know, tennis or whatever. You have to adapt. You're not hired just because you watch reality TV. You're hired because you're a copywriter, you're a creative, and you can create content. You have to just adapt.
What skill set would you call that adaptive skill set to tap into both your left and your right brain? Like I said, days you're in the office, you're creating, you're pitching, you're talking. Days when you're at home, you're live tweeting, you're being flexible, adaptable, depending on what show's on. So you're tapping into both elements of your brain on a regular basis. It's something that everyone can do quite easily.
No, I realise it's not, because a lot of my friends always try to get me to write their captions for Instagram. So I realise that it doesn't come easy for everyone. I'm like, you need help? Really?
Do you help them out? Are you like the go-to person?
Yeah, I've helped them out. But the more they lean into their creativity, especially if they have like their own projects that happen to be on social media, they eventually find their own tone of voice. But I always help them out initially. Yeah, definitely.
So you did that, enjoying Love Island, a show won an award. So you're doing really, really well. And then you pivoted into like BBC and podcasting and production of podcasting and being an award-winning podcast. How did that come about?
So me and Raj, who was my co-host for Reality Team, me and Raj worked together. We were both freelancers, and we were both on the core team. So it's interesting. It was like me and her, we kind of like specialized in the pop culture content, I would say. Everyone did everything, but that was like that's what we were really good at. And a lot of people on the team were actually comedians. So it sharpens your copywriting skills when you're working with comedians. So, you know, people who are comedians, they don't have work all the time. So this is like the kind of work they do to make some money when they're not on the road or when they're not doing shows. So you work with a lot of comedians. So you learn quickly. Everyone learns from each other really quickly. But when me and Raj used to be in the office together, we would just be talking so much. Everyone and their mum would hear us, right? And they were like, you two are just something else. People always say, you two need your own show, you two need your own show. She used to work in radio production beforehand, and she got a call up one day and they were like, hey, I see you've been doing this reality stuff. We're looking for a reality podcast. Do you want to come in? So she got pulled into that. Me and her were working as like a creative team on some of the projects. So she was like, well, I'm working with this girl. We work well together. Can I bring her along? So she brought me along to the meetings. She brought me along to the, where we came up with the campaign. I did that with her. And yeah, then we went. She had that. She recommended me. I went with her. So when the opportunity came around, she had already left where I was. So it was just me there. And I had to make a decision because I was told, it was a conflict of interest. So I had to make a decision.
What helped you choose?
I'd done what I was doing for a while. I needed a new challenge.
When you stepped into that role of producing first, because initially was you pitched the show, you got it, but you weren't supposed to be the talent. You weren't supposed to be the people who were front and center. You were looking for people, weren't you?
Yeah, we were running chemistry sessions looking for people. And then the same thing that our old team used to say is what they said. They were like, do you know what? You two talk a lot. You need a moment. You're passionate about it. You go and do a chemistry test. They loved our chemistry test and gave us the opportunity to front the podcast, and it was one of the best experiences of my life.
What did you enjoy about it most?
Do you know what? Looking back at it, I enjoyed the team that me and Raj had. You know, when you meet somebody, we always used to call each other like work wives. You meet somebody that you can really bounce off of, somebody with a similar work ethic to you, somebody who's better at certain things than you, and some things you're better at, and then like you just bounce off each other. The amount of episodes we released, we never missed one beat, because if one was up and one was down, we would pull each other up. Do you know what I mean? When you're working in a team like that, it's like we were unstoppable. We made so much happen, and we made it happen by ourselves. We're a small little cog in a massive operation. So when you've got big shows, no one should be checking for two small girls. You know what I mean? So we did our own press. We booked our own guests. We wrote our own scripts. And it created some noise without us having the infrastructure that bigger shows had. So I think through that, we managed to build momentum and also gain respect from the people that we worked with. They were like, okay, these girls are serious. And since then, that's why both of us have gone on to work as producers and do other shows, because that show, Reality Tea, worked as a vehicle, one, for us to discover our own passions of podcasting, the kind of things we want to do individually, but also it showed people that these girls know how to run a production without and run a production independently. Like, you can lead them to it. We don't need them. You don't need to baby them. And that's all a busy team need, right? A busy team with a million other shows, they just need someone they can trust to get the job done and get the job done well.
There's something around the end-to-end that I think you both held down, because when we were talking earlier around budgets, you did everything. So it wasn't just the front of house, what the flashy stuff that people saw. It was the teams, the studios, the guests, the press, like you mentioned, and even looking after the budget, editorial decision, all that kind of stuff, which is a lot of work. Being able to do that and do that really, really well, to the point that obviously you all did it and you got recognized for it, an award, that's absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
So, and I'm doing it for the first time as well.
Yeah.
So it sounded like those skills were already honed, and you just need that environment, that platform, just to activate that and get it out into the world, which is dope.
Yeah. That show changed the trajectory of my career 100%, without a doubt.
And now you have your own podcast.
I have the
No Approval podcast.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you've talked about is it's a celebration of saying no, to seeking approval, and yes, to living your life on your own terms. So that's my question to you then. What was the last time you said no to something and you said yes to you?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I've been saying no to a lot of full-time jobs coming my way. I've been saying no, especially in the past 2 weeks. That's what I've been saying no to. And it's because I know, I have an idea in my head of what I want my life to look like. And a lot of people around me do not understand why I would go down this new path I'm going down. And so I'm saying no to them because I know if I say no to them right now, I'm going to get closer to what I want to do. And I believe the way in which I want to live my life, I believe it's possible. I believe it's doable. It's not going to be easy. So yeah, even in this economic crisis, I'm saying no to a lot of full-time work at the moment. I'm saying no. And I'm saying no to projects that are too long-term. I'm enjoying taking on short-term projects at the moment. So that's something that I've been saying no to. And to some people, they just don't understand. Some people don't understand it. But I get it. And that's all that matters.
You're willing to share what it is that you're waiting for, what you're stepping into?
Not quite yet. Not quite yet. Let's wait till it plays out. But I just believe that what I will say is that where I'm at in my life and in my career is that I'm also at the understanding that sometimes, and a lot of creatives don't want to hear this, sometimes creative work takes money. Creative work sometimes needs an investment, and the investment isn't always money. Sometimes the investment is time, right? So I want to pursue a few more of my own creative projects, but I also want a sense of stability. So I'm trying to put an infrastructure in place that gives me that stability so I don't have to worry as much on what I can pursue and when I can pursue it, if that makes sense. So that's the infrastructure I'm trying to create for myself. And there's a lot of people out there that have done it and are doing it in their own individual way. So I really respect that a lot. And then also it means that it leaves you open so that when something does tickle your fancy or tickles your interest, it's like then you can pursue it because you've kept yourself open enough for that project. And I feel like those projects are coming, maybe not now, maybe later this year, we'll see. So I'm keeping myself open enough for them while putting infrastructures in place.
Love that. I think it is very easy to fill your time with stuff rather than recognizing that you need your time, you need that time to build. And sometimes building doesn't always look like progress to other people because it means saying no to opportunities, but actually it's that short-term pay for long-term gain, which actually allows you to do more opportunities because you've got that infrastructure, that foundation in place because you're taking the time to do it right now. So 100% get it. It's a very smart play.
There's a lot of people doing it, and I feel like it's either, there's a lot of people do it, but I think sometimes people just focus on the sexy things they do.
Yeah.
And don't realize all that other hard work they're doing. They just focus on that. But I think sometimes if you want that, you've got to do those other things. So that's what I would say. Yeah, and maybe just a bit more ownership for me is what I want next as well. A bit more ownership. When I want certain things, I'm stubborn about it. And even in my contracting, like, I'm very honest with my clients. I'm like, I love producing, but I want to exec produce, okay? So let's talk about that.
Makes a difference.
An executive producer is just the next level up. You're less involved in the day-to-day stuff. You're more just an overseer. You have a deep understanding of the editorial. You say yes, you know, you're like the final say of certain things. Whereas a producer, you're in the mix, right? You're in the mix. You're in the studio. It's all the fun stuff, if I'm being honest. The producing stuff is the fun stuff. But I think I've also had to, and I still love producing and stuff, but I definitely, this year, I'll let everyone know, I want an exec producer credit this year.
So if I'm a business, an organization, I'm listening to you from either a content production exec, content production perspective, or a content creation perspective, and I'm like, ooh, I like what Pillar's saying. I want to work with her. What kind of businesses that you are looking to work with that align with that approach you currently have right now?
So the other approach I have right now is I've been doing a lot of pop culture work, and I love pop culture work. It's very easy to me. But I'm also really keen to do a lot more storytelling on important subjects, maybe some taboo subjects, looking for stories that haven't been told before, or looking for stories that And maybe this is a thing that I get to do myself in my own show, is that stories that maybe affect people that are my age group. Because when I produce content, I would say that it's very heavily more skewed for a younger audience. So I would love to do some work around things that are important for my age group or other niches, if that makes sense. So women of like childbearing years, so to speak, there's different stories and taboos and stuff that we can tap into there. But then also, you know, I'm from Zambia. I love Southern African stories that we don't really get to hear as much. So I'm just very open on hearing like what's interesting, what will get us thinking, what can shift culture forward, what can even just shift our mindset forward. I don't just do pop culture work, is what I'm also trying to tell my clients, right? give me some, let's take on some challenging work, some challenging subjects. And I'm in talks with some really good things that are coming that way. I do tap in and tap out, but yeah, just a lot more of that work would be great to me. As much as I love pop culture, as much as I love entertainment, still keep that coming. But also, I do want to touch on other things that are really interesting, stimulate the mind a bit.
And I guess my last question to you then would be, how do you define leadership?
I think for me, I would say leadership is leading by example. And what I mean by that is you have to know yourself thoroughly first. I think if you know yourself thoroughly first, you know the ways in which you can help and affect other people and their careers. That's what I would say. Because I think that we've all worked with people in leadership positions that don't necessarily lead you in the right way. And I think maybe what's missing from that is because they don't know who they are as a leader. So I think you have to really understand how you work, what you want, how you want to have impact. And then you're going to know the people. When you're putting people into your team, you're going to know who it is that's going to fit into your team, and how you think that you can have good impact on them.
Well, when I think about what you just described around, you just shared around your career, your life, your journey, I can see so many threads around how you've been able to learn from different things that you've gone through, utilize that to help you move forward, but then that's also created new lanes and new avenues for other people to be able to shine, not just from the work that you do out front, but the work that you do behind the scenes. Because you're someone who also knows, supports a lot of people don't know about behind the scenes, like help them to get into the industry and learning and talking and always being that source of that fountain of knowledge to so many different people. So you actually practice exactly what you described. You do that in such a massive way, which I think is really, really important. And it's great to see and learn and hear about what life is like behind the camera. Where the non-sexy, non-glamorous life of things that people don't tend to get a vision of. But actually, you describe it in such a way that showcases that, yes, it's hard work, but it's fun. It's fun. You can do something that is fun, that you enjoy, and do on your own terms without necessarily being defined by what other people think they should do. And I think that's very, very important when it comes to being able to be involved in something you're doing day in and day out and living a life that you really want to live as well. So thank you for sharing for that.
Thank you. And also, I think it's as well, like, good leadership as well is trusting the people that you hire. Like, sometimes if I'm in production teams, there could be like 20 of us, right? And if it's the visual team, I trust in them to do what they're doing. I will spend time with them. You know, if something doesn't necessarily look right, we can talk about it, we can question it, but I trust them and give them the grace and the time to fix the things. If I'm like, you know what, the lighting wasn't working on this skin tone, I noticed that on last week's episode, how do we fix that for this week? So I think also just having that trust and having that relationship with your team enables everybody to do their best work. I'm not a micromanager, and I don't like being micromanaged either. So I trust in people to do what they're an expert in doing, but also having tough conversations with them if that isn't working for the project or for me.
How can people find you and work with you and inquire about working with you, should I say?
So I'll say LinkedIn is number one. So Pilar Nalwimba on LinkedIn, but also you can always see my work on my website, www.pillarofsociety.com. And I am, of course, on Instagram at Pillar of Society, where you'll find links to, you know, all the work that I do. I do upload a lot on Instagram, what I'm doing work-wise, because for me, it does work almost as good as LinkedIn in terms of like inbound work, inbound inquiries. It works really good. But yeah, LinkedIn, website, then Instagram.
Well, you've heard it. You've heard her, you've heard it. And if you are someone who's in that area, who's in that space, and you want to work with someone who's killing the game, like she knows what she's doing, she's got the receipts to back it up, then reach out to people and work with her. But this is Everyday Leadership. We'll see you all next week. While you're still recovering from that amazing conversation, let me give a quick preview of what we got coming up next week. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out.
Yeah, it can be a very powerful place, and I think that's what really unlocked like the poetry, unlocked the podcast show, it unlocked like all these other elements to me, because I felt like once I started to do the therapy again and I started to really tap into my wounds, I started to notice like, bruv, if I've gone through all of this, I'm still standing, then there must be a reason. So I might as well just push on, because, you know, what's the point of going through all of this if I'm not kind of manifesting my future in the way that I see fit? It doesn't make sense.